So it will help if you have that passage open, beginning of 2 Samuel. It will also help if you've got one of these, the extra bonus handouts you got this morning. On the side without the pictures, I've given you kind of a way in to where we've got to in 1 and 2 Samuel. We won't go through all of it now. You can go away and have a look at that a bit further. But it does help to know where we're landing. We're going to come across something called the Christ, which means God's anointed or chosen. And often it means a king. And we're going to come across King David, who is the sort of supreme human example of that. But as we look at him and what he's doing, we're going to always be pointed forwards to the greater Christ, Jesus the Christ, God's perfect king. And then in 1 Samuel, God's people are in God's place, in God's land. They've been ruled by judges, but the people said, no, we want kings like the places around us. So they got a king. They got Saul. Saul was rejected by God because he disobeyed God. And particularly, he didn't destroy the Amalekites, which will come back into this passage. So then God chooses David, and he's anointed as king. But he's not king. Saul is king. And there's this great tension with Saul as king, but David's anointed as king, and what's going to happen? And they chase each other around, and all sorts of things happen in one Samuel. I recommend it to you. Very exciting stories. But our task for this morning is to try and persuade you and show you what is useful in this passage as we come to God's words. And I think one of the key things is we need to remember things are not always what they seem. So if you turn over here to have a look at the pictures, you'll see a couple of classic sort of optical illusion type things. There's a picture on the left. Some of you may see an old lady. Some of you may see a young lady. Some may not be able to see one or not be able to see the other. An example of things not always being what they seem. Or next to that is a sort of classic trident. If you look at the top, it looks like sort of there are two sticks coming off the base. Are there more, Liz? Are you looking for some? Does anyone not have them? Because there's a little bit of moving around. Leslie doesn't have one. Brilliant. At one end it looks like two sticks, the other end it looks like three sticks. What's going on? All is not what it seems. And here as we come in, we're going to see this account. How is the kingdom going to come to David? Does it need a push, like it suggested? Does the old king need to be killed? No, God's kingdom will come by kingdom principles. God is going to be in charge. And our first title is this, Christ Can't Be Tricked. Verse 1 to 16, this story of the young Amalekite, Christ can't be tricked. The man arrives on the scene. He is young, we're told. He's an Amalekite, describes himself as an alien, which means he's kind of living in Israel, but he's not an Israelite. He's escaped from Saul's Israelite camp, where the Philistines have just defeated them. He's killed Saul at the request of Saul. He brought the crown and the royal band to David, and he falls to the ground to pay honour to David. It looks good. It sounds okay. But things are not always what they seem. The language here in the text says this young man is bringing a report. So already we're thinking, this might not be the true facts. And here, and as you read a book like 2 Samuel, it's quite difficult to get a handle on it. One of the things that helps is context. Context. What is going on around this passage? And the context here helps us to expose the falsehood. This young Amalekite is a liar and a plotter. The context at the end of chapter 1 Samuel, chapter 31, is that we find out that Saul actually kills himself. The Amalekite's not involved. And anyway, if you pause for a thought, how does an enemy get anywhere near the king? He's surrounded by his bodyguards. There's no way he's going to be the last man there. Instead, he's clearly nicked the crown and scooted off with a plan. We have the context of David's behaviour. All the way through 1 Samuel, David has shown that he will not take the crown for himself. He will not just treat God's king how he wants. In 1 Samuel 26, he says, Lord forbid, I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. He's consistently not snatched the crown for himself. And here in this passage, verse 13 and 14, he questions the man. Have you been in this country? Yeah, I've been in the country. Well, then you should know. Who are you to put your hand on the Lord's anointed? And finally, the context here, even of verse 1. David has returned from defeating the Amalekites, literally striking them down. And here this Amalekite thinks that David will be pleased, keen for the crown. Instead, he is struck down. In the end, he's punished for what he didn't do, but what he said he did. He's intended to trick and lie, and it rebounds on him seriously, because you cannot trick the Christ. In Psalm 51, if you know it, and in other places, again and again we're told God sees to our inner parts. Jesus, in that Luke reading, says, there is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. What you've said in the dark will be heard in the daylight. What you whisper in the ear in the inner room will be proclaimed from the roofs. You cannot trick Christ. Trying to trick God is like a small child who say, go and hide and play hide and seek. And they cover their eyes and say, you can't see me now. It's ridiculous. It's silly, isn't it? I wonder if you read this first part in chapter 1, you think, well, this story seems a bit negative, people being killed and all that, so we don't like this thing. But this conniving Amalekite forces me and you to confront our own sin and attitudes to God. You see, Jesus is a king to be trusted for your salvation, but not treated lightly. There is a good fear in salvation that Jesus speaks about. It's not a fear grounded in sin that you might get punished. But it's a right fear grounded in love and a right respect for God's King. So don't think that you can lie to God like you can to others. Or even we sometimes lie to ourselves, don't we? I'm doing okay. That sin doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. As long as I do that good thing, it doesn't matter how I grumble and hate whilst doing it. God sees us. Christ cannot be tricked. Well, Christ cannot be tricked. Our second title here is Christ should be honoured. Right at the centre of this account in verse 11 and 12, we see David honouring God's man in his mourning. He tears his clothes, he weeps, he fasts. And here we see the structure of how the writer writes helps us. Because right, he's placed right in the middle this grief. We've had the Amalekite man, the conversation, then the grief, then a conversation, and then the Amalekite man. The grief he places right at the centre. It's actually a strange way of writing. I mean, what's the Amalekite doing while everyone wails and moans and rips their clothes? But the writer wants us to see this is the key thing. The mourning of the death of Saul. If you're someone who's worried about chronology, think about one day a giraffe appearing on the cricket pitch down in White Waltham Village. You might ask someone who was there, well, what did you do today? And they could start with breakfast and toilet and all those sorts of things, but they're likely to start with a giraffe. That's what we do. This was the most important thing. And that's what the writer has done, put this important thing about grief in the middle. And then there's this lament, which we didn't have read, because we don't have that much time this morning, but verse 17 to 27, the second half of chapter 1, is the lament. I just want to draw out some things there, because lament is not often spoken on. It's an important part of life. First of all, the fact that David writes a lament at all in verse 17. Grief is for the mind as well as just for emotions. It's not kind of necessarily a sort of wild thing, but actually we engage our minds as we think about what grieves us, what makes us sad or cross. We have grief and belief further down. In verse 20 and 21, David flags up this is a religious shame as well as a political one. They're doing down Israel's God as well as Israel, because Israel was the people of God. So David teaches this on. He wants people to take up this lament as a motivation in heart and mind of future generations. God's people should be ready to suffer for the sake of God. Then there's grief and thanks. In the centre of the poem again, there's thanksgiving for the lives of the fallen. We know that from our own funeral services, don't we? What can we learn? Well, the rejection of God's King, unbelief and error, should lead us to sadness and mourning. Not just analysing where the world might be going wrong or where some parts of the church are going wrong, but real passion for God. We should strongly feel the rejection of God's ways in the world. I wonder when the next time a psalm of lament will be turned into a worship song. But it should be part of our life, shouldn't it? We see things going wrong and we feel it. And then as a side note, as well as David wanted to point us to God and to God's Christ and how this has fallen and been rejected. This is also about personal grief. In verse 25 and 26 of chapter 1, David cries over his friend Jonathan. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain in your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of a woman. Jonathan and David are best mates. They have been together in battle. They've forged this deep friendship. And that deepest love turns to deepest grief. Some of us will have known that for ourselves or know others. Bereavement is very sad at the time, and then on an anniversary or Christmas or a particular special time, it comes back. It can erupt and subside. And David has provided for this by writing this lament, facing it. We're not to mourn hopelessly like other men. We can prepare ourselves by passages like 1 Thessalonians 4, reminding ourselves we will be reunited with Jesus and others, or Romans 8, nothing can separate us from God's love. But we can mourn. Death is a bad thing. The loss of love of someone should and does hurt. So there's grief, grief that engages the mind, grief that's coloured by our belief where we're pointed to Christ. Christ cannot be tricked, and he should be honoured. But then notice something about this passage. Chapter 1, verse 1 to 27 is sort of a hinge. 1 Samuel, the king Saul, now he's dead. Long live the king David. Saul lost the kingdom for plundering Amalekites, now Amalekite has plundered him. Saul claimed to have wiped out the Amalekites but didn't. Now an Amalekite claims to have killed him but didn't. Meanwhile, David, the true Christ, has been striking down the Amalekites, carrying out God's purposes. And do you notice there in verse 2? On the third day, I don't know if that rings any bells for you, but it's as if we're having the true Christ promised right here. So our final thought is, so then choose Christ. In chapter 2, verse 1 to 11, we have two kingdoms described. The writer wants us to see a clear compare and contrast between two kingdoms, a kingdom under divine guidance versus a kingdom of human ambition. So verse 1 to 4, one kingdom is under God's. David seeks the Lord's guidance. Where shall I go next? Hebron. You will be king over Judah. It's repeated three times, king over Judah. So David leaves completely from Philistia, where he's been based. He takes his family and men to make a new beginning in Judah. Hebron is a significant place. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob are buried there. Finally, we get to see David as God's chosen king, ruling visibly on earth. But they're pretty unpromising, small beginnings. It's just Judah. It's one tribe. But don't lots of Christians live and work in a sort of Hebron state? Don't we have kind of small things, maybe low times? When you look around at our church and think, well, we're not many versus all the world's pressures. But we trust, as the New Testament says again and again, that Jesus' resurrection proves a coming kingdom. The king will be seen to rule in power and glory over all. In verse 8 to 11, we see another kingdom. Where one kingdom was under divine guidance, this other worldly kingdom is opposing the Lord by stubborn defiance. Their hostility to David is also a rejection of God and his promises. Even Saul had realized that David was his anointed successor. And this continued, this hostility. Abner bringing Ish-bosheth and then other members of Saul's family to fight against David. The rejection and conflict continues and continues to this day until Jesus comes again. Jesus speaks of expecting this hostility. And this is our experience of this world, isn't it? One kingdom under divine guidance, one kingdom of human ambition. So then choose. And again, the writer has this lovely bit in between the two kingdoms of this bunch of people under the title Jabesh Gilead. We see David extending the kingdom with winsome appeal. He's noticed that Jabesh Gilead has been kind to Saul. They've always been pro-Saul. So David says to them, he shows great thanks to them. And in several verses, he says great thanks. He sent messages to the men of Jabesh Gilead. The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul, your master. by burying them. Then he has a proposal for them. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favour because you have done this. And then he has a direct invitation. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Yes, this is political. This is king and kingdom stuff. But can we see it's also evangelistic? It's sincere. David praises them for allegiance to Saul. But he calls them to submit to God's king with winsomeness, like Jesus, who says, take my yoke on you and find rest. It'll take guts for the people of Jabesh-Gilead to respond. It takes guts to define one kingdom to submit to God's king. So I was thinking about us when I was thinking about this. Christmas is coming, and a range of different events. When we're inviting our friends, our family, others that we know, to come to know our Father God this Christmas, can we be winsome and yet also call them to submit to Jesus as Lord? Can we help them with that brave step to defy the kingdom of the world to come into the kingdom of Jesus? Do you know that for yourself? And can we be bold to call others to it? So, 2 Samuel. Things are not always what they seem here on earth. Let's lift our eyes to trust the God who's in charge and see his all-powerful King Jesus. Then we'll not be tempted to try and trick Christ, but we'll be honest with him and confess and come and try and follow him. Then we'll honour Christ as he should be honoured. And we'll be glad to have chosen Christ, no matter how weak or small his kingdom may look to us now, because he will come again to judge the living and dead and rule in glory forever.